O-R-G. Thanks.
Greetings. I'm Askia Muhammad, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. Joining me in the studio today is Grace Cavalieri. She is no stranger to WPFW. For many years, Grace Cavalieri hosted the program, The Poet and the Poem, on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. This morning, we are going to talk about her memoir, Life Upon the Wicked Stage. Welcome.
Thank you. This is so great to be on the other side of the mic.
Okay, great. Grace, I found your memoir to be a book that examines not just your literary career, but one that addresses motherhood as well as women in the workplace. It's a book filled with many well-known people, but perhaps at the center of everything is the love story between you and your husband, Ken Flynn. Ken died on January 18, 2013. You were married to him for 60 years. Let's begin with you reading and talking about the poem, 1952.
Thank you, Ethelbert. This is 1952. There you sit in the open cockpit. I never saw such a smile. Goggles pushed up on your head, shoulders harnessed with a parachute to keep you safe. This would be before you were on 9 carriers, before exile to Vietnam, before your children surrounded you like stars waiting for your kiss, before the autumns of our lives, before there would be no autumns, before I said, don't fly away, before you would become someone else, then back again, before there would be so much sun outside without you, before the winds were light and variable, before you'd sit on the front step every time I went to the store, waiting for my return. There you sit, sitting in a cockpit of an SNJ, smiling at me for all eternity. In a moment that could not last, cleared for flight, everything in the whole blue world ahead of you.
Grace Cavalieri. Grace, you know, I have to ask you the question, what did it mean being a Navy's wife?
It was really tough. Being a military wife is something that I think hasn't been written about enough. I can just tell you that I have PTSD to this day. I mean, chapter 2 is having a baby with putting a sign up in the commissary, will somebody babysit my other 3 children? Can I get a ride to the hospital? You know, it was extremely hard. And when the men were gone, it was known. And I was stalked because it would be known. We were living on a base,
right?
When the squadron was gone. It was extremely difficult.
Do you think things have changed on these bases?
I'm afraid not. I'm afraid not. The only thing that we have now that we did not have then is a Navy support system, because when Ken died, I was able to go to a Navy counselor and have a great grief counselor who really worked so well and opened so many doors. But 40, 50 years ago, we did not have that. And of course, Ken was gone. He never saw the children, the twins, between their 2nd and 4th birthday. So it was quite hard.
Mm-hmm. So how did you create art out of this sort of climate?
Well, you know, Ethelbert, that you're born an artist. You know very well that writers are wired at birth. I mean, I've interviewed 3,000 poets, and everyone will say, you know, you won't believe this, but I wrote as a child. And I'll say, no, really?
Right. But we also know that many women still have to let their careers put it on hold until the kids are older.
Well, writing you can do after you defrost the meat for dinner, you know. And I was confined to the house. Now, imagine me in Whidbey Island during the rain with 3 children under 5. And what are you going to do? So I remember writing my first manuscript and sending it up to the review in Seattle. And here I was, a Navy wife, pregnant with my 4th child. But I got a wonderful response. And that little bit of fire that kept burning, you know, every once in a while kept me going.
What was motivating? Is the motivation coming in terms of, well, I want to do something with this time? Or am I trying to escape from this? Or I want to be successful as a writer and get out of this.
It isn't about success, really. It's about expression. It's about you have all these feelings. What are you going to do with them? I mean, who are you going to talk to? Who are you going to tell?
Well, I find many women, will try to at least develop their own group.
We had Navy wives. I tell you, it was an island of women and children. I'm thinking of one. Of course, I've lived in 13 Navy stations. But Whidbey Island, for instance, all women and children, all the men were gone. And it was, I'll tell you, it was a sisterhood that I could not live without. I think that I've gone through my life searching for sisters, and in the Navy you find them.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are three women who seem to have deeply affected your life and work. Talk about Mary Wollstonecraft, Anna Nicole Smith, and Harriet Powers.
Oh, Ethelbert, I am so happy that you read this book. Nobody has read it in depth like this. You really did.
Well,
I'm telling
you, Grace.
You get a gold star. Right. Mary Wollstonecraft, I felt, actually all three of those are about women in the workplace.
In different centuries also.
Oh, yeah. First about, I'll just take, which one?
Did you name, Shelley, she's from...
Mary Wollstonecraft's
right.
daughter,
so Shelley, but
Mary
your daughter's Shelley.
Oh, I did name my daughter Shelley after the poet,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
So Mary Wollstonecraft was the first woman who wrote the most serious book in English. All the other women were writing fluffy prose, you know. And Mary Wollstonecraft was in the 18th century, and she wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women. Mm-hmm. But she loved the men. And so I got a great conflict there in my book. But the thing I saw about her, which I felt too, was early on in PBS when you're the only woman in the boardroom and the ceiling is very low, and here you're a suburban wife from Annandale, and everybody else is wearing designer clothes. You know, I really knew what Mary Wollstonecraft went through. Mm. She was not a blue stocking, but she was fighting for her expression. And in the play and in the book, I have her vindication is that she finally likes her name, the way people say her name. And that's really an important vibe.
Yeah, my introduction to her, when I go back, I find it very interesting. The person who introduced me to her was June Jordan. She said, "You have to read this book, Ethelbert." You know, she had a biography on her. And that's with my introduction to her.
Well, you were probably the only man who knew it 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah. So talk about Anna Nicole Smith.
You know, I love her. I love her. Do you remember her?
Sure. And you, in your book, you talk about how after she's given birth and we see a different Anna Nicole Smith. Talk about that.
Gosh, you really did read this book. Well, I did see her on television, and I saw the beauty that she had without the makeup, the high cheekbones and the ponytail, the false eyelashes, holding this baby. And I knew once you've had a baby and another woman's holding a baby, you know what they feel. And I thought, you know, there's something in her we haven't seen before. So I wanted to vindicate her. All of my plays vindicate women in some way or another. And so I actually looked into her life. She was considered a train wreck, but I saw her vulnerability. And so my play is about that, and my book of poems is about that. And it is finally that she knows who she is at the end. And she, I won't say she likes her name, but she likes who she is. And so I think she emerges as a different person. I believe that her image has changed.
This is interesting about image, because when I read your memoir, I felt that throughout, you were concerned about your image, because you put a lot of emphasis on fashion wherever you're working. I don't care if it was PBS or any, you have this reference to what you're wearing.
Don't look at me now. I have my work clothes on.
This is radio.
You know, that is so interesting, because I think that that represents something, mm-hmm. doesn't it? And with you, you're absolutely the greatest dresser in the world. So there's something about what you put on that's a statement.
Right.
And I think my dream of being an artist and my dream, which I was born into, of always manufacturing and producing and processing this, it was connected with how it looked. I remember when I was on television in the 50s, I had won a trip to Sweden from an essay I wrote. I remember exactly the dress I wore. Black, long sleeves, very tight, round neck, and I can just see that dress. it just represented who I felt I wanted to be.
Well, talk about Harriet Powers.
You know, she was an unknown genius, as you know, and her quilts hang in the Smithsonian and the Boston Museum of Art. And so the Smithsonian commissioned me to write a screenplay about her with Bill Gilcher, whom you know, at the University of Maryland. And we knew nothing but that she had made this quilt, and we knew she sold her for $5, which was half the asking price, to a white art teacher. We knew she had children and a husband, and that was it. So we spent 1 year going to Athens and going down to the courthouse and going through mildew papers. And slaves' papers were not kept very well, as you know.
Right.
And we went and searched where her cabin was. And I created a world, a population about her. And then money was not found for PBS, so I converted it into a play. Mm-hmm. And with the help of great quilt makers of the day.
Okay.
So I think she's going to live.
I hope so. And I hope this station lives too. This is WPFW. I'm talking to Grace Cavalieri. The show's On the Margin. We hope that if you like what you're hearing, that you will support this station. WPFW is essential to who we are in this city. Grace, you've had a number of jobs that placed you in the center of some interesting projects. You worked at PBS from 1978 to 1982. You also worked at the endowment from 1983 to 1988. You mentioned in your book, the workplace is nothing but a laboratory, the place where we work our differences. My question is that many times in the laboratory we fail. What's your response to that?
No, the laboratory is where they push your buttons and you find out what you're made of.
Right.
But I did, PBS was a paradise. I mean, I'm coming from WPFW. And I'm coming from hippie Antioch College, Goddard. And here we have this palatial L'Enfant Plaza with a receptionist and rugs and everything. And I got to meet the greatest people. So I was the assistant director of children's programming. And
I want you to talk about the importance of programs for children, especially now. Has it changed? Were there things that perhaps you wanted to do that you didn't get support?
When I went in, it was 1978. I was still at WPFW working both places. And we had nothing but cartoons and Sesame Street. That's all. So as the assistant director of children's programming, I was in charge of the daytime schedule. One of the first things that were on was Lucille Clifton's vegetable soup and Footprints. And partly because PBS had a high consciousness, there was fabulous children's programming. But I must say that Sesame Street was the great beacon and clarion voice in this country for children. At this moment, it has been reduced to something on HBO that can't even be used by people without a fee. So I don't feel very good about that, actually. And we lobbied Congress for a children's endowment for television, which never did get through, with the Children's Defense Fund. We always dreamed of having children's programming as more than entertainment. Of course, Sesame Street's educational, but we always dreamed of having a possibility of using it for children who were abused and reaching out to let them know that somebody was watching them, somebody was noticing, somebody knew about these things. None of that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how I feel. I feel that the computer is now our arbiter for human behavior, and we have to remain very vigilant.
Let's look at something a little closer, because I look at you in this workplace, and it's just deal with PBS. Are you like fighting against a structure of people that maybe just are not sensitive to this issue?
You must have been in the workplace. Well, at PBS, when I was there, children's programming was considered second-class programming. You know, they wanted prime-time programming. And it was the first time, this was in the early days, you know, 78, they didn't even have all of the stations in the country running the same programs primetime like they do now. It was a little bit primitive. Children's programming had to fight for everything against the establishment, because what PBS wanted to do was to be a fourth network. And now, as you see with all the commercials, it is a fourth network. And they really, education was just not sexy, and it didn't bring in money. So the education really was getting done, which was ITV. It's called a television system that goes into the classrooms. And that was where the real learning was going on. But we had the daytime schedule, and we had to fill it up. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of PBS, but we got, I'll tell you, it was really tough. Mm-hmm. It was really tough. My boss got fired, mm-hmm. and I was just hanging in there.
Well, you know, one thing which I didn't know, and I was happy to read in your book, I just didn't know you were associated with this, but you were responsible for Voices and Visions.
I
that,
was.
That 13-part series.
Did you know it?
No, I didn't know. I know the series, but
I didn't know. Yeah, that's what I'm the series. Yeah. Yeah, that was a little stroke of luck. As you were, we were saying before we went on microphone, mm-hmm. that sometimes we cannot predict what's going to happen.
Right.
You were just talking to me about some things that happened in your lives. Well, at PBS, I was introduced to a young man who was going to start the series. And because I was the only one who knew poetry, I got to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, luckily, after 5 years at PBS, what happened is I went to NEH. And guess what? He was there waiting in line for the money.
Mm.
Since I knew about the development of this for 5 years, all I could do was shepherd that through. But, you had to go through the planning stages, the scripting stages, and the production stages. It took them 5 years and $1 million. But fortunately, I could shepherd that.
How was it difficult to get this down to like a 13-part series when you look at American Letters?
No, because first of all, there was just dead people. And, if we had to do contemporary poets today, Ethelbert, where would you start?
Right.
You yourself know 20,000 personally. So when you take the icons, mm-hmm. and you take T.S. Eliot and all of the great dead poets that are our dominant figures.
But let's look at that. We know, for example, if we look in the classroom, especially in terms of curriculum development, especially as we came through, say, for example, the women's movement in the 70s, it got into the question, okay, if I put this person in, I have to take somebody out. So you're still dealing with 13, but you have to make some decisions. And somebody who looks at the program say, well, how could you do this series and you didn't have so-and-so? Did you receive that?
Yes, but of course I wasn't the producer. Right. You understand? I'm just the funder.
Right.
So all I had to do is keep it on track. I really didn't make all of the decisions. He had to consult with me about everyone, mm-hmm. but he had the last word. Nowadays, we'd have a very different configuration, I think. Mm-hmm. A very different configuration of 13 people.
Mm-hmm. Read an excerpt from your memoir, Life Upon the Wicked Stage.
Okay. Shall we talk about PBS or NEH?
Yeah.
Okay. I would miss PBS. What happened is they brought someone in from commercial television to run the children's programming.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see where they were going.
Right.
I would miss PBS. I worked with many celebrities and had the fun of being hand-in-hand with the creators of Nickelodeon. That channel would compete with us, but we were friendly advocates of children's programming. In my view, all good material was welcomed, just to drown out the cartoon staining children's minds. At PBS, we lobbied Congress for an endowment for children's television. As the Annenberg studies showed, cartoon violence, bigotry, ageism, and sexism were making an indentation on all minds, not only children's. We had worked with the Annenberg Foundation and universities to move our cause forward. Among the good luck I had with this creative, productive, spectacular workplace was to become personal friends with Mr. Rogers. We met at a PBS conference and spent much time together. At dinner one night, we were eating and talking about poetry when suddenly there was a line of children forming at our table. Fred Rogers stopped eating and spoke to every one of them. He never finished his meal. I sent him a poetry book of mine with some very bold poems. It was excellent for the poetry community, but not for the sainted Mr. Rogers or my bosses, also unwelcoming recipients. Where was my radar? Fred Rogers wrote sweet notes for all subsequent books, not that one. Here's the contribution Fred Rogers made to our culture and civilization. Before his appearance on local Pittsburgh TV, the nation was watching the program Captain Kangaroo with Mr. Green Jeans, and my children grew up on these shows, and they were wholesome entertainment. But Fred Rogers was the first person in the history of broadcasting that appeared before children as a person, unadorned, talking about feelings, a genuine person. He demonstrated authenticity instead of just talking about it.
You've been listening to Grace Cavalieri reading from a memoir, Life Upon the Wicked Stage. The show is On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller, and we hope that you'll call the station 1-800-222-9739 and pledge your support to WPFW 89.3. Grace, we're talking about poetry. I remember you once called D.C. the poetry capital of the world, but in your memoir, you place us third after New York and San Francisco, so I said we must now be the Philadelphia Phillies. Where are we today? What would it take to be in first place?
I think, Ethelbert, you've got us there. You've worked long and hard, and you finally did it. I believe truly that, and you and I have traveled all over the country, there is no other city that has a community of poets like our city. Now, I truly mean this. New York has more people. New York has more venues, and they've got more money. And Chicago is now pretty hot with, you know, the foundation there. Where can you have a city where people are not backstabbing each other, where we are not stepping on other people's backs to get up the rung? Early on, something happened in the 70s where there seemed to be an unspoken agreement that we were family. And by God, it's been that way. I bet you know the name of every poet in Washington.
Well, I'm going to ask you that question. You give space and attention to many of the Library of Congress poetry consultant and U.S. poet laureates in your book. Mm-hmm. Are there any poets that you feel that you discovered while you were here at WPFW?
Wilford Cardi, the Trinidadian poet.
Oh, Wilford Cardi, Blonde.
Remember
Blonde, yeah.
The last right. of the poets? Then. He was a blind poet.
Right. Excellent critic also.
Trinidad. Yeah. And he came when we were early on. Mm-hmm. He would turn his paper over to write. He'd write a line and then he'd turn the paper over and write another line. And I do not believe he had a platform before he came on this air, even though in Trinidad he was well known.
Right.
So he was one person. And I think a lot of young poets, Farida Allah,
right.
You knew her well. She, Ruby Saunders is her other name. She just hit this station like storm. We did a lot of jazz poetry, and she got picked up by Sweden. Mm-hmm. She got CDs made in Sweden. So I think WPFW launched a lot of people.
And you put together the anthology.
It's still in print, as a matter of fact. We're going to feature it at AWP next year. Okay. It will be 20th year. The first 300 poets that were on WPFW are in the anthology. Joseph Brodsky, Lucille Clifton, as well as some people's first poem.
Right. You know, you have a chapter about the station in your memoir, a good reason for our listeners to purchase your book and continue supporting WPFW. Was it difficult to write about this station?
The station disrupted my household terribly. Oh my gosh. It was my life. Mm-hmm. Because we spent 3 years finding funding to put it on the air, and it was what I wanted my whole life. Mm-hmm. Because I'd been on radio as a child and was not able, you know, when you're growing up in the 50s, you either are a teacher or a nurse, right?
Right.
So I was one of them, and the radio was still in the background. So when I finally, the children were in junior high and high school, and I was really able to get the money from NEA, from Leonard Randolph, you remember him.
Right.
We started with 8 arts programming a week, film criticism, writing workshops on the air, all of these poetry programs, children's theater, live theater. It was really quite cool. But my mind was always on WPFW. I would cook breakfast in the, I would cook dinner in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. And Angel, my fourth child, would say, I'm not eating this at night. It tastes too tense. You know? So I'd get home for dinner, but PFW consumed my life. Okay, I'm going to read a little chapter of that. WPFW was my life force, and I spent too much time whining and dining poets, chasing them, transporting them. I have guilt about this, but the girls were well. Ken was prospering as a realtor, and although he went to Southern Maryland and I went north to D.C., we'd meet in the middle, and the girls always had one of us. He supported us, and I was allowed to follow my dream because of this. I feel bad about all the women artists in the world who do not have a Ken to plug them into the purpose of life. My girls saw me as independent and a great role model, they tell me now, but that was only allowed because I had a roof over my head and the bills were paid. And after the first 3 years, I was a volunteer at WPFW for 20 years. At the same time, during the WPFW interim, I did have other jobs that actually paid salaries, although I wanted the careers. I cared less about earning money than following my passions. However, with the thought of colleges, even on a modest scale, money was needed for the girls. When I left the WPFW station full-time in 1978 to go to PBS, I still kept my weekly show, The Poet and the Poem, appearing weekly on air live, no matter where else I worked. It was a shadow life, a parallel universe. I was at WPFW every week. The wacky station, where in the beginning we had to keep people from sleeping on the floor at night, where we forbade marijuana in the bathrooms, where tapes were erased if someone needed a blank one, where editing was done with scotch tape and scissors for years, and where I met the great jazz and blues singers, Big Mama Thornton, Little Esther, Anthony Braxton, Betty Carter, among others. They all came through the station in the early days. Life was a jazz paradise.
And paradise is being here with Grace Cavallari on WPFW. We'll be back on On the Margin in a few minutes. We're going to take a break. But before we do, support our station, 1-800-222-9739.
Hi, I'm Angelique Bain, and this is your WPFW Social Justice Calendar for the Washington metro area. Thursday, May 26th, in honor of African Liberation Day, Thought in Action Consulting hosts a viewing of the film Apocalypse Africa, Made in America, followed by discussion on transcontinental connection building led by Netfa Freeman. 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at IPS, 1301 Connecticut Avenue Northwest. It is a free event, but a donation will be requested and registration is required for entry. Register by finding Apocalypse Africa Made in America on eventbrite.com or call 202-787-5229. Friday, May 27th, the Woodson-Banneker-Jackson Bay Division 330 UNIA ACL will host a forum on Africa's Liberty, Myth or Reality, featuring panelists Maurice Carney from Friends of the Congo and Obi Egbuna, correspondent for Zimbabwe and activist. 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Emoja House, 2015 Bunker Hill Road, Northeast, Washington, D.C. For more information, call 301-789-4784 or visit uniadivision330.org. If you'd like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the webpage ips-dc.org/social-justice-calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Okay, we're back on the margin, and Grace Cavallari is here, and we're also being joined by Corey Thomas. Corey Thomas is the author of the play When January Feels Like Summer. It's now at the Mosaic Theater. The Mosaic Theater operates out of the Atlanta Performing Center at 1333 8th Street, Northeast. Corey, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and you're here with Grace Cavalieri. And before I talk to you, Grace is going to make a pitch for listening to the station.
I hope you don't mind, Corey, if I just take a minute and say, we
Please.
Have to keep this station on the air. This has been built with blood and sweat. And I'll tell you, in 1977, it had been 5 years that Pacifica had been fighting to get this station on the air because it was the last FM band on the dial, and it's been kept away because they were afraid it was a dangerous voice in the city. And it took 5 years of litigation. Finally went on the air. The number's 1-800-222-9739. We cannot lose this important voice. It is the only true station, really, that's telling the facts that there are, and poetry. It is, I remember when Ethelbert was with me when we started the station, and he brought poets to tell our station manager that there had to be an important emotional element to WPFW. You know, this was built with nothing but the human heart and with people that volunteer and give their heart and spirit to this. Please call 202-588-9739. You know, we're not asking for the last dollar bill in your wallet. We're asking for one on the top. If everyone that knew Ethelbert sent in $1, this station could function for a year. I'm telling you, if you have ever been on this station, please call. If you've ever listened to this station, please call. If you've ever worked for this station, you really just take a little bit off the top. 1-800-222-9739. This was built with the heart and the soul of Washington.
Thank you, Grace Cavalieri. And now we move from poetry to playwriting. Corey, you have this play, When January Feels Like Summer, that's here in our city. Could you talk a little briefly about what the play's about? What makes it timely for today?
Well, I guess the subject matter that makes it timely would be the transgender character. That's a storyline that's sort of come to the forefront right now in the news with Caitlyn Jenner,
right,
and at the moment the bathroom situation.
You have an East Indian transgender character, right?
Excuse me?
You have an East Indian transgender character in your production.
That is correct. There's an East Indian transgender male to female character, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that if a person comes to this play, do you think they're going to leave the theater talking about? Or what you would like them to talk about?
Yeah, well, what I would like them to think about or talk about is that the people that we pass in the street every day, because it is a play about five characters, so it's not a play that is only centered around that one character. It's a play that has a transgender character in it, and it's a character that's going through the transition. And so some of the other characters relate to that character and her situation. But each one of them has a unique story. There's two immigrants, and the other three are African-Americans. There's two young African-American men and one slightly older African-American man who's a sanitation worker.
Mm-hmm.
But they're basically the kind of people that I think in general, unless you know them personally, you sort of just pass by them on the street if you see them and don't think about them. You know, you don't pay them any mind. And
you know,
so
I remember listening to an interview that you gave.
Is that by being forced to sit in a theater...
Mm-hmm. I remember an interview you gave in which you talk about you like to place characters on a stage that sort of like, you know, sort of interact that you would not normally
yes.
see.
Yeah, I like to put different types of people together on a stage and then see them work situations out together.
You know, when I saw that, I went back to, I was thinking about back in 2004, we had the movie Crash that was set in L.A., and people in that movie seemed as if they were separated by walls and locks. When people interact on your stage, what keeps them apart?
Their race, mm-hmm. their gender, their ethnicity. So I guess there's social status in life, education, all of those things. Even though they live in the same city and that sometimes occupy the same seat of a subway car.
Okay. Well, this play, When January Feels Like Summer, this was produced also in Pittsburgh and New York, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. I was wondering, in terms of you as a playwright going through these different productions, are you also perhaps rewriting and revising as you go from, like, say, Pittsburgh here to D.C.? Has a play changed in any structural way?
I am always rewriting. I will say that this time around, which is the third production of the play, I didn't really rewrite. And I sat there on opening night because I wasn't really involved in the entire rehearsal process, because usually I'm sitting in rehearsal every day. But I didn't have a strong, overwhelming, like, oh my goodness, I have to change that. So that's a good thing, I think. And I think it's the first time I've ever.
Does that say something about Mosaic Theater?
Maybe. It might say something about it.
Chris, you have a question for?
Well, I was just thinking, I've never been at a rehearsal of my plays because I had four children, and I thought, oh my, if I could only get in the sandbox with the actors, you know, but I never did have that chance. Let me ask you this. Was it difficult to get the play mounted? I find it's very hard to get productions these days. Corey?
It is impossible almost. Yes. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Corey?
There was a little pocket or something. It's almost impossible to get productions these days, and my agent has told me it's even harder to get a second production than it is a first.
So this must be pretty wonderful that you had three productions of this play. I'm really impressed.
It is amazing.
It's all about money. It's all about money. I know. I feel that the one great way of getting a play produced is to join competitions. Do you agree with this? Because you at least know it's getting read. When you throw them,
yes, I do.
Of course, you have an agent, which is a bonus. But some of us who do not, you can't just throw a play in over at the transom. So competitions,
no,
you know, are being read, and that is so fair.
Okay.
I agree.
Okay, we're going to ask you to hang up, and we're going to call you back till we get a better connection.
Okay.
Okay. And meanwhile, those of you, okay, we'll be 1 minute.
We can pitch.
Okay.
I just want to say, where else can you get this? Where else can you get this? You know, what would you feel like if you turned on your radio and there was nothing here at 89.3 FM? And it's that serious. I'm really telling you, it is that serious. That to stay alive, the WPFW, like all five Pacifica stations, has chosen to have no corporate underwriting because it does not believe in answering to anyone's ideology. So for that privilege, what means that if it's a people station, it's got to be funded by the people. Even $5, $20, $30, we know what it's like. But if everyone listening sent in a $5 bill right now, they could pay the rent. We're not talking 50. We're talking little bits. So if everyone did it, then 202-588-9739. There are no phones ringing right now. And this program especially, you want to keep on the air.
You know, Grace, you take your memoir, Life Upon the Wicked Stage. Is the stage always wicked?
You read it, didn't you? My opening of Anna Nicole, Sandy, the hurricane struck, and all the subways were filled with water. And I'm still looking for my second production, Corey. I also, when Harriet Power's play opened at the Smithsonian, do you remember that guy that drove up from the South, that crazy guy in the tractor with all the dynamite?
Oh, yeah, I remember that, right.
Parked at the reflection pool right behind my Constitution Avenue.
Right.
They had to cordon off all Constitution Avenue, and all these black churches were bringing buses full of people they never could get through. Mm. We did fill the auditorium, but it was all with the walkers. So that was another thing. Pinecrest Rest Haven, my play, was scheduled to open on 9/11. It did finally open several months later, but I've had three kind of shocks.
You know, I'm glad you made it to the station today.
Do you think there's a little black cloud? But I do believe my life is perfectly balanced, and I do have equal amounts of great spirit and joy to make up for those.
Do you, I mean, we're going to try to get Corey back in our conversation, but do you have time to make it to some of the productions around the city in terms of looking at the new plays?
You know, I used to review theater in Washington in the 80s, and I saw every play that it was put on. But at the time, now that I'm living out of town, it is a little bit harder. I was making all the matinees. They were giving all the press tickets to press night, and I said, could I please have mine in the matinees because I can't drive at night? And so I was doing that for a while. But I'm seeing more around my area, Annapolis, Baltimore. I really do want to get more into Washington. I just have to hire a limo, that's all.
Right. You know, how important are theater reviews? I wanted to talk about that to Corey in terms of, you know, these productions come out, we want somebody to go see them, but do we feel that one person, for example, says something and that should be it? Corey's back on the line. Corey, we're talking about reviews and how important they are to productions. Corey? Well, Grace, maybe you can answer that question.
I can tell you that as a reviewer myself, I made a pledge, and you know you've read my reviews, that if I cannot find, I'm on the side of the creator. If I cannot find something to appreciate in that, I will not write it. Mm-hmm. There's enough people saying no in this world. And the fact is that one critic can truly put down a play, close a play.
Corey, have you ever had that problem happen to you?
I haven't had them. I've had them put it down. I had one reviewer one time say I should never have been born. So they can be, some reviewers can be very mean-spirited. And I don't really understand why, you know, some of them seem to enjoy on just being mean for the sake of meanness, because it's one thing to talk critically about a play, but it's another thing to try to actually, you know, impede the success. A reviewer can stop a person's career in its tracks, totally. Especially in New York, it's really very, some of those reviewers are really scary.
How was it in Pittsburgh?
In Pittsburgh, it was fine. In Pittsburgh, the play was received very well. This was a different play. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was so shocked because to me, it's like a very mild tempered play. You know, they said I should never have been born. Can you imagine?
You can't say much worse than that.
Corey, I want to ask you about the playwright director relationship and how has that been at Mosaic?
You know, Serge and I had never worked before together. We had a few long phone conversations and emails before the rehearsal process. I was really impressed because he seemed to really be very dedicated to wanting to understand each character and what my intentions were. And we spoke a few times, I think, during the process of the rehearsal. So it's always very important to me that there's that open door between the director and myself, because I do like to be able to feel that they really understand the play that they're directing.
Do you come into that relationship where you say, okay, I'm meeting Serge for the first time, I'm just going to listen, or do you go and say, well, I've got some questions first, and you know, I'm familiar with the work of this theater, and I hope they don't do this and that, but or do you just go in and say, okay, I'm just going to listen? Corey? I guess he's listening.
I'll answer that.
Okay.
I think it's a collaboration, it's a pie, and you're just a piece of it. That's one thing the writer learns really early on. And I have never had a director but once make the play exactly as I wanted it. I've had them make them better, and I've had them make them worse. But I've only had one person, J.W. Roan, in South Carolina, Quilting the Sun, his version of it, was just what I dreamed of. Mm-hmm. And speaking of critics, Quilting the Sun was done in Center Stage Greenville, and it was a very God-centered play. Unfortunately, the only reviewer in Greenville was an atheist, and that didn't go over so well.
Okay. You know, we're having a problem with Corey Thomas. Her connection is very bad. So she's sort of coming in and out, like, I guess, like sunspots and something like that. But we did receive a pledge from Rachel Burns. I want to thank you for making a donation, a $100 donation to WPFW.
Thank you, thank you, Rachel. Thank you very much, thank Rachel. You.
So this is wonderful. And I have a lot to do with Grace Cavalieri being here and also Corey Thomas.
Yes. And I think that we need to talk a little bit more about the station, though, first, Ethelbert, because this program has been on just about a month or two, right? And it has been already garnering so much enthusiasm in the city, because we're all, as I say, you represent the tribe. And so we have to keep this going. You know, this is the station in the nation. Even NPR is now very corporate funded. And this is the only station that the people have their say. I listen all day, and the many different voices are people that just come in, and they all have a cause. They are all making changes in this country. Could you support that? Could you support that? Could you support the music and the poetry and the humanity? It's the only place you're going to get it.
Okay.
1-800-222-9739, and the other number is 202-588-9739. We would like 5 phone rings right now.
Okay. Thank you, Grace Cavalieri. She's my guest, along with Corey Thomas, who I think we've lost. We had a very bad phone connection. But I want to encourage all of you also to, if you're listening to the show, to look out for her play, which is at the Mosaic Theater right now, located at the Atlas Performing Center, 1333 8th Street Northeast. The play is When January Feels Like Summer by Corey Thomas. So please contact Mosaic Theater and support Corey's play. Grace, I want to get back to something you said in your memoir, Life Upon the Wicked Stage, and then this is something you say early in the book. You talk about art heals. And in what way?
You and I both know, personally, it does. And second of all, when you say something that is very deep inside of you and somebody else hears it, they think, oh my gosh, I have felt that, but I've never said it out loud. So what you're doing is really creating a space where people are safe, because your feelings, look, we're all the same. Nothing has changed. Every one of us, before we left the kitchen, has felt everything a person can feel. We felt betrayal. We felt rejection. We felt love. We felt being blamed for something we didn't get, credit for something we didn't. Everyone is the same, but all of us have hidden these things away. So when the artist says something, and then the listener says, oh, that's me. That's me. I can say it too. That's a spiritual revolution, and that is healing. And I think there's more room on the outside, as my grief counselor said, for feelings than there are on the inside.
Talking about your grief counselor, throughout your book, you make reference to your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, not everyone in your audience is going to approve of this, but there are some people who can see beyond the veil. And I feel that in evolution, we no longer have tails and 6 toes. We now,
I still do.
I see that 6 toe, very handsome. But when you think that evolution is still going on, it is not physically anymore, it's psychic and spiritual, and that we're still evolving, and that some people on Earth have just an extra neuron or whatever it is, and they have that ability to see beyond the veil. And I think in a couple hundred years we all will, because, you know, we know more than we did in the 1800s about what everyone's doing. So in 1982 at PBS, my boss said, the psychic's coming to town. And I thought, oh, my God, so Hitler had a psychic, you know. And my husband and I were having a real rough patch at that time. So I thought I'd go talk to him. Well, it changed my life. The man told me things I had never said out loud. And that validated his authority. Mm-hmm. He did have the gift of sight. So Brian Christopher is his name. He's a great spiritual leader. And since 1982, I've consulted him. And since then, I've met, oh my gosh, there's many, many tolerable psychics now. And so I have gone to them, and I have, since Ken died, I have been able to I don't know if I'm going to get hate mail, but I have been able to contact him.
You know, before we end our show, Grace, I want to ask you some questions about, you know, we talked about poetry. We talked a little bit about playwriting with Corey Thomas. But you also are a publisher. And talk about that part of your life.
Well, you and I both know that it doesn't do any good to keep it home, right? You got to spread it out. And so early on, I saw that many, many good poets, I saw that the big publishing houses were conglomerates. They were now being owned by AT&T and all of these places. And I thought, you know, some very fine poets are just not going to get there, mostly all of my friends. So we started the Bunny and the Crocodile
Press.
Where'd
you get that name from?
In the New Yorker, there was a picture of a big crocodile with his mouth open and this teeny bunny inside of his jaws, not knowing that the jaws were going to shut.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's poetry. So we started that, and we did about a book a year since.
You started out with Bob Sargent, you know.
We did five of his books.
Yeah, I remember Bob Sargent and other people that you, what was Michael Glazer, you know, I think Kenny Andar. I think he did Kenny Carroll.
We did.
Kenny Carroll, Rose Solari. You know, I mean, when you look at this, Stacey Tuthill, I say these names.
She's
because
dead,
some people are not with us anymore.
And too.
Are these books still in print?
Yes, they are. Okay. They're in my bedroom. That's what in print means, they're in boxes.
And then Hillary Thamm, you know, I thought was a very wonderful in the person. And then a woman who's doing workshops in our community, that's Ann Becker.
Powerhouse.
She was a poetry poet laureate of Tacoma Park. And I didn't even realize you also did Janetta Rose Barris.
Where is she?
She's on the show.
I know.
Right. So
it's the first time she's emerged. I remember she was used to be on the Washington Times.
Right. And, well, she has emerged, and so has Corey Thomas. Corey, how are you doing?
I'm back, yes.
Now, you know what? Just to let our listeners know, where are you calling from?
From San Francisco.
You see? You know, that's going on out there. Well, we're glad to find you now and then. Are you coming back to D.C.?
I will be coming back to D.C. I'll be back there for closing, and I think I'll be there on the
What's the date? For the date of the closing?
It is the 12th.
Okay.
June 12th.
June 12th. So I hope that our listeners, since you broke up and we lost a good amount of time with you, that we'll have an opportunity to meet you in person. I hope that those of us who are listening to the show will go out and support When January Feels Like Summer. What the Mosaic Theater is putting out, and I think it's just wonderful that, you know, your play is which is timely, is being performed here in Washington, D.C.
It is a thrill to be there in Washington, D.C. I'm so excited, and to be the last play at Mosaic's inaugural season, I felt very honored to be in that spot.
Well, meeting you, I've only met you once, and I felt that was a great honor. And Corey, I want to thank you for taking time out and waking up a little early out there, and being on my show. I'm sorry for the little interruptions, but, you know, art, like life, doesn't have permanent interruptions, and so we can hopefully keep our relationship going. And I look forward when you come back to D.C., okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Corey. We've received a number of pledges. We see a wonderful $50 pledge from Nubia Kai, which actually was one of my guests on the show. Mm. Nubia, thank you very much for supporting WPFW. And then we have Bridget Rousson, $100 contribution. Bridget was such a wonderful person. I saw Bridget recently at the wonderful WPFW benefit that Annie Shalak hosted at Mule Bone. And I remember Bridget standing there in the corner waiting to hear the poetry of Nikki Giovanni. Bridget Rousson, a wonderful woman, a very talented individual. And Nubia Kai, who I think I still owe a book blurb to. So I want to thank you.
If Nubia, you've ever rubbed against Ethelbert, then I want you to call 1-800-222-9739.
So you support the station, I'll support you, and we all get along well. But I want to thank everyone. You know, today, Grace, you know, you've been just an institution here in Washington, D.C., and there are a number of people when I think about people who just loved you. One was Amisu Bolton. When I go back and look at the 1970s and Amis and Mae Miller, you know, what was happening here was something that was very beautiful, you know.
Didn't happen anywhere else. Yeah. It did not. This was really the Renaissance. This was not the Harlem Renaissance in New York. This was really the Renaissance. Poetry Black South was
Energy Black South.
Energy
Press,
Black
right?
South.
Hoodoo
Press.
Magazine.
Hoodoo.
And Alan Austin with Black Box Magazine. You know.
This was really the center of culture. And it still is. It was Paris in the 20s.
Right.
And Alma Sue Bolton and I bonded very deeply. And I felt very bad about his loss. We have some sweet letters that went back and forth. And I've written some poetry to him. But he came in was he here just 5 years?
About that. Yeah. And then he just disappeared away.
He went back south. And, of course, his wife is the famous Harriet.
Woman wife, right. So I want to thank you, Grace, you know, for your time, and I hope that maybe there's a second part to Life Upon the Wicked Stage. Before I go, I'm going to take this pledge that's been handed to me. Oh, Rick Reinhardt, the photographer, has made a donation of $50. Rick,
thank you, Rick.
This is really good. Now he won't be able to. He'll support the station, which is good. He won't be able to buy me lunch next month, but
he
I don't mind.
He can do both.
He can do both. Okay.
Eat small.
Right. Okay.
And we need more of those people.
Right. So, yeah, Rick Reinhardt, you know, Nubia Kai, Bridget
Masson. What great guys.
Thank you very much for supporting, you know, WPFW.
People can still keep calling in.
The show is On the Margin. And my name is E. Ethelbert Miller. My guests today have been Grace Cavallari, the author of Life Upon the Wicked Stage, her memoir, as well as the winning playwright Corey Thomas, who has given us the play When January Feels Like Summer, which is still at the Mosaic Theater. Thank you for listening to On the Margin. The station is WPFW 89.3.
vez has pensado en producir un programa radial comunitario? Si es así, entonces pon mucha atención.
La Mesa Nacional de Pacífica aprobó una moción para implementar 5 horas de nueva programación en español.
Semanales.
En cada una de las estaciones de Pacífica.